Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's no Copenhagen in terms of hype or potential for policy clout, but today kicks off a United Nations climate conference in Cancun, Mexico, that many hope will lead to more results than the unsuccessful 2009 Copenhagen conference. The Copenhagen Accord ended up as only a loose set of voluntary actions that nations can opt into or not, but it lacked any sort of enforcement mechanism for all the hype that went into Copenhagen being the new Kyoto last year. But 1 year after world leaders failed to come to any meaningful agreements to slow global warming, the political environment for environmentalism has shifted in this country. The 2010 midterm elections have set up the 112th Congress to be unsympathetic to the environmental cause, with Republican leadership in the House expressing doubt about the basic tenets of climate change. Governor Christie, too, in New Jersey. So what will environmental legislation look like over the next year? Is there any intersection left between the world of climate science and climate policy? Darren Samuelson, the senior energy and environment reporter for Politico, joins us now to update us on what the 112th Congress heralds for the environment. And Orrin H. Pilkey, and he's the James Duke Professor Emeritus of Geology at Duke University, is here to tell us about his current research on coastlines and rising sea levels. So we will match the politics and the science. Welcome both of you to WNYC. Hello.
Pleased to be here.
Good morning.
And shortly we'll also check in on how an environmental question that was actually on the ballot in California did on Election Day. But Darren, let's start with you. Cap and trade was dead probably before the midterm elections. The Republican wave in the House didn't improve its chances very much. What's next?
Well, we'll start off in January with a series of attempts to try and ratchet back on the EPA's ability to regulate for greenhouse gases in absence of congressional action. So the Environmental Protection Agency has authority under the Supreme Court, a decision from 2007, to regulate greenhouse gases from cars and trucks and power plants. And they have already started on the cars. And power plants are next, with other big major industrial sources also coming up. And the Republican Congress will be investigating those regulations and trying to vote in the House to repeal them. And they'll try in the Senate as well, where there's a couple of moderate Democrats who want to do it too.
There's one name I'm hearing as significant in this anticipated effort, Representative Ralph Hall. Is that the right person to be focusing on?
He's definitely one of them. He's going to be the new chairman of the House Science Committee next year, which will have some authority to investigate climate change science. And he has indicated that he wants to look back at the stolen ClimateGate emails of a year ago and look at whether or not climate researchers were concocting results and keeping dissenters out. But probably the focus on the policy side is less Ralph Hall and more the chair of the new Energy and Commerce Committee in the House, which is probably one of the most powerful committees in the House of Representatives. And right now we don't know who that chairman is going to be. In the next couple of days, the Republicans will be deciding whether or not it'll be Joe Barton, the Texas Republican who famously apologized to BP for the Obama administration's quote-unquote shakedown during the oil spill earlier this summer, or will it be Fred Upton, a Michigan but is getting attacked by conservatives for not being conservative enough. He's got a little bit of a moderate voting record on social issues. And there's a couple other dark horses, John Shimkus, who has said that global warming isn't a problem, that we don't need to deal with it, and that God promised Noah in Genesis that only he would be the person to lead to the end of the earth, and therefore we don't need to be doing anything about it. He said that publicly, and he's also in the running.
In fact, we have that clip. Here is Republican Congressman John Shimkus of Southern Illinois from a congressional hearing in 2009.
The right of free speech is a great right that we have in this country. Very few times we use it to espouse our theological or religious beliefs, but we do have members of the clergy here as members of the panel. So I want to start with Genesis 8. Verse 21 and 22, Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. I believe that's the infallible word of God, and that's the way it's going to be for his creation. The second verse comes from Matthew 24. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. The earth will end only when God declares it's time to be over. Man will not destroy this earth. This earth will not be destroyed by a flood. And I appreciate having panelists here who are men of faith, and we can get into the theological discourse of that position. But I do believe God's word is infallible, unchanging, perfect.
Republican Congressman John Shimkus of Illinois, who could be the next head of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, with his reflections on God and global warming. Is it fair to say, though, Darren, that it would be a stretch to say that that's sort of the Republican policy on global warming?
It's a little bit of a stretch, yeah. He made those remarks about 2 years ago during a hearing where there were clergy testifying about the need to help the poorest countries in the world. And he did repeat those comments recently in an interview I did with him. So he's certainly in that place. And there are, I'd say, about 50, 60 new Republican House members joining the Congress next year who do have doubts about science. Whether or not it's connected to the Bible or not is one thing. But there are just people who just doubt, the science and question whether or not climate scientists have been manipulating this. I mean, Jim Inhofe, senator from Oklahoma, who's been around and is the leader of the Environment Committee for the Republicans in the Senate, you know, called this the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on mankind 5, 6, 7 years ago and still stands by that. So there are a number of members who are just dubious on the science. And, that's one of the hurdles to trying to pass cap and trade legislation.
Let's turn to a scientist also with us right now, Professor Emeritus of Geology at Duke University, Oren Pilkey. And Professor Pilkey, in your work, I gather you're advising coastal communities to plan for a rise in sea level of about 5 feet by the year 2100. It's a long time from now, but can you give us a quick crash course in how you arrived at that number?
Well, that number is actually based on a number of panels, state panels from coastal states, about 12 of them, that all have come up with essentially the same number of a minimal 3 foot sea level rise by the year 2100, and we now think we are seeing an acceleration in both the melting of the Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheet, and so 5 feet seems like a safer number to, in terms of planning, in terms of the future, especially for the cities like Boston and especially Miami. My gosh, Miami's in real trouble, and so much of the city is below 3 feet in elevation. The intellectual level of the debate in this country is just so distressing because the field evidence is so overwhelming that the sea level is rising. The sea level will continue to rise, and that global change is upon us.
So, do you think that, regardless of the ongoing debate about climate change and whether we need preventive policy measures like a carbon tax or cap and trade or whatever, that Congress should also be dealing with disaster planning?
Absolutely. I believe maybe another way to put it is just preparation for sea level rise. For example, on the sea level rise issue, we could prohibit all future construction of high rises on barrier islands. Because high rises make it almost impossible to respond flexibly to sea level rise, which is going to require moving buildings. A 3 foot sea level rise, to put this into context, will affect, we have a 3,500 mile plus or minus long barrier island chain from New York to the Mexican border. And 3 feet will be the end of development there. Unless the individual island is completely surrounded by a massive seawall, the beaches cannot be maintained at that point. And so, but the problem is at the point we come to 3 feet, the sea level will be impacting on the cities. And the cities are certainly going to crump the barrier islands for funding. So it is a dismal future for sea level for barrier islands unless they begin planning now. And step number one could be to prohibit future high rises on these islands.
So Darren from Politico, he mentioned Miami. Oh, my God, Miami and what they're facing. How about the new senator from Miami who's considered a Tea Party senator, Marco Rubio? What's his position on whether global warming is real and needs to be addressed at the federal level?
Marco Rubio is an interesting case, actually. Obviously endorsed by the Tea Party and pushed heavily there, raised doubts about global warming science during the campaign as he ran against Charlie Crist to capture the Republican vote. As the Speaker of the House, he actually worked with Crist as governor to try and pass legislation, which I believe Crist signed, that did put caps on emission limits. And this was a couple of years ago when I think the politics were a little bit different on climate change. And Governor Crist was a little bit more popular and had what many thought was a fair shot at becoming the next senator. And just to back up a little bit, the senators that Rubio replaces, George Lemieux and before him Mel Martinez, were Republicans from Florida who indicated interest in climate legislation but never quite made that jump to be co-sponsors or to actually endorse climate caps, cap and trade. They always were indicating that they were concerned about the cost to Florida consumers when electricity rates, they say, would go up associated with a climate bill. So it's different than the Democratic senator from the state of Florida, Bill Nelson, who has endorsed carbon limits, but also he linked it to the offshore drilling and BP oil spill that took place in the summer as well.
So, Professor, do you think Congress should be having debates on, say, how many feet the oceans are going to rise, such as you're having in the scientific community, rather than over whether or not man can be blamed for global climate change?
Yes, I think including the human connection, which essentially all scientists believe in, that is something that kind of ruins the debate in a way. I think we could. I think the Congress should listen to the scientific community and act accordingly. I think, but somehow the credibility of the scientific community has been really damaged in all things. But science has done so much for this country, and I think the ignoring it like we're doing in the Congress right now is just an amazing phenomenon. But
let me take a phone call for you about the credibility of the scientific community and one of the reasons that it's been damaged. Phil in Queens, you're on WNYC. Phil, thanks for calling.
Hey, have you been?
Okay.
I think the main issue that's turned people's heads is the revelation of the East Anglia emails, where they have been leaving out information. Even Al Gore's hockey stick graft had been, which is now famous from his movie, left out information. So people, I think most people feel that there's something going on with the climate, but it's happened before. If anybody's ever been to Ephesus, Ephesus used to be a great harbor. Now it's filled in with silt. The world's climate changes. Whether man is doing anything about it is another question, and common sense says no, and some of the scientists, there are 30,000 scientists that say no against 3,000 who say yes. And beyond that, common sense also, are you guys still there?
Yes.
That China and India haven't signed on, common sense also tells people that we are going to destroy our industry if we regulate ourselves, and we're already pretty much in the hole with manufacturing and this and that. So those are my issues, and I think more and more, even if it's only on Fox News and conservative radio, more people realize that there's another side of the coin.
Where does the number come from that you cited, 30,000 scientists?
You can Google it. Have one of your producers or assistants Google it right now. There are almost 30,000 scientists who have signed on, that say that man does not have an impact.
Versus 3,000. Well,
I think it's approximate numbers.
Well, we will check that. But, Phil, thank you for your call. And Darren from Politico, are you familiar with that stat? Is that one that's going around?
Yeah, there are a number of petitions that have been signed by scientists who represent, from the geology world, or it's not climate scientists, people who, in the meteorology world, this is a lively debate over sort of the whether or not climate change is real. I think the overwhelming evidence suggests that it is, that humans are causing it, and there have been a number of investigations on the ClimateGate email, quote-unquote, scandal from a year ago, and most have exonerated those scientists, and that these are basically just, the lingo that scientists use as they email back and forth with each other can sometimes be difficult for a layman to follow, and so that's part of what happened a year ago, and those stories that came out last year questioning the people at the East Anglia University, I think most of that has died down. It's sort of I was interviewing Ivo de Boer, who's the former UN climate chief, who said, quoted Shakespeare and said it was much ado about nothing, though it's certainly been something that the skeptics have held on to and will continue to hold on to as we go forward.
But if there are 30,000 scientists who've signed some petitions, I think as we are looking it up, it comes from something called the Heartland Institute. Go ahead.
That's a conservative right wing.
Professor, was that you?
That was me here. If I can, this is sometimes called the Oregon petition from Dr. Robinson. The 30,000 people are for the most part engineers, and very, very few of them are researchers or experts in climatology. And it's a very distressing kind of petition, sending out petitions randomly. And the phraseology of the petition is such that it attracted some people who were believers. So I think there's no question, in spite of what that caller says, that the those who have done research in this, in fact, there's a survey of research climatologists showing that 97% of them are firm believers in the human connection. But whether or not you believe in the human connection, the fact is the Earth is warming, and we can see it in so many ways. We can see it in the melting of the ice, the rising of the sea level, the melting of permafrost, the melting of mountain glaciers, and on and on and on. It's just the evidence is absolutely overwhelming that the Earth is warming right now. And, yes, everything that's happening now has happened in the geologic past, but this is different. We're here now. We're here now. We're along the shoreline. And so forth and so on. So it's a different thing than the geologic past.
So should we be having the discussion at a policy level about triage, the unthinkable questions of saving cities versus coastal islands, that kind of thing?
Oh, we certainly should be having those discussions right now, because we are going to begin to feel, for example, sea level rise in 40 to 60 years is going to be we shouldn't be thinking just of 2100. And furthermore, it's going to happen. It's happening. And there's little doubt that it will continue, that the sea level rise will continue. All indications are that the ice, melting of the ice is accelerating, and we should not keep our head in the sand on this. Cities like Miami is in the worst case of all, because Miami is sitting on top of a very porous limestone, and Miami, for example, could put levees around the city to fight the sea level rise, but the water would just simply go right under the city, and so the levees will make no difference. Miami has to, in particular, make plans very quickly.
And Darren, last question, are there any plans to make plans in the Congress, even as cap and trade dies and preventive measures, if we accept the science that carbon produces the global warming and other emissions, that even if nothing is done on a preventive basis, is Congress prepared to deal with mitigation as sea levels rise?
Short answer, no. Long answer, I think they've left it up to the states to do what they will, and a number of states have moved at the state government level over the last 5-10 years on adaptation planning from Maryland to Florida to New York City. So a number of states are. At the federal level, I think, we moved now to a phase where the stars were probably as aligned as they were going to be for mitigation, a reduction. And it didn't happen. It passed in the House a year and a half ago, but failed in the Senate to get 60 votes. And now we're looking for alternatives. President Obama has said he's looking at trying to deal with this issue in chunks, so to speak. And they say that they can still get there without a cap on emissions from the mandatory level. EPA is one route. Spending on renewable energy is another. And, they'll come up with some numbers somehow to show that the emissions are going down. Obviously, the economic recession actually helped reduce some of the U.S. emissions over the last couple of years, too. But to actually pass a big, comprehensive bill, I think the time has passed, and, we now need to probably look beyond the presidential election of 2012 to see, and there's a huge question of if Obama wins a second term or not, whether or not another push will happen.
Darren Samuelson, the senior energy and environment reporter for Politico. Orrin Pilkey, the James Duke Professor Emeritus of Geology at Duke University. Thank you both very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And what a difference between the federal government level and the state level. Here in New York, Mayor Bloomberg just announced a series of 3 town hall meetings over the next month or so to plan for New York City's sustainable future in light of global warming. And Californians went to the polls on Election Day and had to decide, in light of all the new politics around global warming, whether to repeal their anti-global warming law. And we'll talk about what happened in California on Election Day and what it means when we continue in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the midterm elections will influence the environmental discussion based on who is currently in power. But there was also a direct vote on an environmental issue in California on Election Day. Proposition 23 on this year's ballot was to freeze a 2006 Global Warming Act until such a point as unemployment dropped below 5.5% in the state. Gary Giro is the president of the Climate Action Reserve, a group opposed to Prop 23, and he joins us now. Gary, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Delighted to be here today.
Now, remind us a little more what was in Prop 23 and how did it do?
Well, Prop 23 would have, as you say, suspended California's global warming law until unemployment reached below 5.5% for 4 consecutive quarters. And by most projections, that was not likely to happen anytime between now and 2020, which is the term that the law would actually take effect. California voters clearly rejected that by a large margin, 61-39. In fact, it was the highest vote-getting proposition on the ballot, even ahead of Prop 19, which was the marijuana legalization. And California voters rejected it for a number of reasons. I think clearly California has shown leadership and been at the forefront of a green economy and didn't want to see that progress stalled, but also saw it really as the cynical corporate ploy that it was. And this wasn't the first time that California voters recently have rejected initiatives sponsored by businesses that were clearly in their own self-interest.
Is California's Global Warming Act much more stringent than what we have in other states?
It is, in fact, much more. It is the only comprehensive global warming law in the United States. It will require that California reduce its emissions to 1990 levels by the year 2020, which is probably about a 20% reduction overall in emissions. And that's just the start of the curve. Ultimately, the goal is to reduce emissions by 80% by 2050. And so it is a comprehensive law. It includes some 72 measures directed at addressing climate change. Some of them are things that are well known and probably in place in other states: energy efficiency and renewables, low carbon fuels, vehicle emission standards that the national government, the federal government, just picked up. But it also includes a comprehensive economy-wide cap and trade that is scheduled to be voted on later in December and implemented starting in January 2012. And that cap and trade will be the first economy-wide cap and trade in the United States. There is, as you probably know, a regional initiative in the Northeast there for electric utilities, but this is going to cover all sectors and will be linked to what's called the Western Climate Initiative, which is a coalition of states and provinces that are going to create a large regional cap-and-trade market. And I was in British Columbia last week, in fact, where they were rolling out their regulations to address climate change and very clearly are going to be linking to the California market.
So if cap and trade has no immediate prospects in Congress, might it become, in effect, the law of the land anyway, region by region? Because there's one in the Northeast. I think it's not as strict as the one in California. But if you're talking about a consortium of Western states and there's already a consortium of Northeast states, is this something that's just going to come about 50 capitals at a time?
Well, I think that's exactly right. In fact, this week there's three regions that are developing programs, and this week in Washington, D.C., the three regions are meeting with EPA to talk about how they link their programs and create a de facto national program. And California has clearly led that with the people in the Northeast, New York and New Jersey in particular, being very active in the regional greenhouse gas initiative.
And with the election of Jerry Brown and the defeat of this proposition in California, where does the environmental movement in that state go from here?
Well, I think we clearly understood that we had to link the economy with the environment and not say that these were in opposition. And that was the clear messaging that came prior to Prop 23 as part of the campaign. And some of the things that came out that I don't think people were fully aware of, you know, California certainly has been an innovator and a leader in clean technology. But more than 60% of all venture capital expended in 2009 was actually in California. That's 60% of North American venture capital. And so Californians and the environmental community here clearly understood that our fates were joined and that we had to find a way to make sure that we could promote a vigorous economy, a new economy, really building the green, clean energy economy of the future rather than trying to hold on to the past of dirty energy.
Gary Giro, president of the Climate Action Reserve, a group that successfully helped to fight Prop 23 in California on Election Day, which would have rolled back the state's Anti-Global Warming Act. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer in WNYC. And coming up next, sex and relationship columnist Dan Savage on his hit YouTube video series for young gays and lesbians called It Gets Better. We'll hear some of the best of those clips and talk to Dan Savage and take your calls on the impact of the It Gets Better campaign and videos in your life and your community. Stay with us.